Podcasting from the beautiful Mile High City, you're listening to the Do It Again podcast, the official podcast of Scientific Wrestling, the undisputed leader in no-holds-barred, catch-as-catch-can wrestling. Here's your host, Jake Shannon.
For tuning in to the Do It Again podcast, the official podcast of Scientific Wrestling, the leader in no holds barred catches catch can wrestling. I am your host, Jake Shannon, and I've got a real treat here. Somebody like that, you know, honestly needs to be more thought of in catch wrestling, even though I don't even know if he really identifies in any way whatsoever as a catch wrestler. But I've got on the line for you guys a guy that I've known for shit, man. It's actually been a long time. Roy Delgado. So for those of you who are just pure catch people may not know who Roy is. Roy's this, and I love Roy because anytime I see a lanky motherfucker go out there and kill it, it does my heart good because I feel like us lanky grapplers have to kind of stick together. And Roy's really killed it. He was a standout on the Ultimate Fighter reality show. He's not only competed in MMA, but Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. I'm not even sure which degree. The guy's a badass. So without further ado, I'll bring him in and he can tell you all that stuff. Roy, are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm right here. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast.
Oh, no worries, dude. I mean, you're one of my favorite people, even though we rarely get a chance to sit down and bullshit. But whenever we do, it's always awesome. So for people that don't know, I mean, you're actually really in the jiu-jitsu community known particularly, I mean, and you put yourself out there for leg locking. Is that fair?
Yeah, for sure. I don't feel like my there's so many black belts in jiu-jitsu, it's very difficult to stand out in jiu-jitsu. But with my background, you know, in catch wrestling and having some sambo influences, I've been able to apply leg locks in jiu-jitsu scenarios within the jiu-jitsu rule set.
Yeah,
really, really effectively. And I've on top of my own accolades as a leg locker, I've been able to influence people at the black belt, you know, adult world championship level, which has really helped me make a name for myself in the jiu-jitsu community for leg locks as well. So, that's what I'm known for mostly.
Well, I love the titles because really, like your first set or the first instructional you put out. And for people who are interested, it's they can go find it's actually done as an app. Digitsu, which is digitsu.com. Could be Digitsu too. We're not sure, but digitsu.com and download it. Google or find search for Roly's name, Roy Delgado. But so it's an IBJJF legal leg lock series. So you took your knowledge of leg lock and said, okay, given this, and I know all these setups and entries and tricks, let me tweak it so you can actually use it in an IBJJF context.
Yeah, exactly. And that, you know, there's this book called The Obstacle is the Way. It's a fantastic book based on stoicism. I really enjoyed it. And so I recommend anybody that's interested in philosophy or stoicism to read it. And so what the way it happened is I was teaching classes where I had MMA fighters in the classes and I had jiu-jitsu guys in the classes and we're doing jiu-jitsu tournaments primarily. And we're also doing MMA. And I was thinking, well, how can I teach a leg lock that everybody can do? And so I started kind of tailoring it towards like, because just because it's IBJJF legal doesn't mean it doesn't work outside of that realm. And so I started kind of like laying on the leg. That's a big thing. It's a really stupid role. And I can criticize the IBJJF more than anybody else because I actually compete in the tournaments and their rule set's horrible, but you still got to play within the rules.
Right.
And so I started laying on the leg and doing my straight ankle lock that way and kind of developing the different entries that were that were positions that you'd find yourself in commonly. And so not, you know, not a bunch of fancy Eminari roles, but like, you know, like locks from passes, like locks from sweeps, like locks from butterfly guard, and then finishing them in a way that was legal. And what happened was I kind of became first to market on a lot of that stuff, because most like lockers,
totally,
they want to reap the knee, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. I love it. But like, leg lockers tend to go right for the heel hook and inverted heel hook. They'll bypass straight ankle locks and knee bars. I think that's a mistake a lot of leg lockers do, but that's typically what leg lockers do. And so I kind of came at it from that perspective. And so the obstacle was the IBJJF rule set, but the way became, I dialed in on the straight ankle lock to a degree that I don't think anybody really had before, because I was forced to. And because I was playing both worlds, you know, I'm rolling no-gi rules in MMA, but I'm also running a really big jiu-jitsu program. So that obstacle became the way for me. And that's how I developed those jiu-jitsu legal leg locks.
Yeah. And so for people who still don't know, and I that's probably my bad. So, you know, when Billy moved to the States, Billy Robinson, you know, he moved to Arkansas because his son, Spencer, was big in the National Guard down there, and he wanted to be close to Spencer. And this was after I had worked out the deal with him to try to give him, some sort of income and figure out how to get him out here in the States. And he walked in to your gym, and he taught there for like 5 years or something crazy, yeah. Right?
Man, yeah, that's a cool story. So like, we're out there on the floor one day, and it's like the middle of the day, and we're training, and this old man walks in with a cane, and he's old as dirt, and he's walking funny, and he's like, hey, and he's like, I'm Billy Robinson, and I wasn't familiar with the name at the time, and he's
yeah,
like,
nobody was, man. When I started, nobody had a clue who Billy was, like a handful of people.
Yeah, and so he asked me, do you guys need a grappling coach? And at the time, we weren't hiring, you know what I mean? Like, and I was like, and I'm looking at his ears.
Yeah.
There's something here. But I was like, man, I remember telling him, like, well, you know, both my partner and I are both BJJ black belts, but we're not like hiring one, but you know, I'd be happy to talk with you about it. But I remember telling him that, we were both black belts in jiu-jitsu, and the look on his face was one of the least impressed looks. And having a black belt in jiu-jitsu takes a ton of time.
Yeah, yeah, it's like, a hard thing.
Yeah, yeah, it's nothing to blow off. But like, he literally couldn't have cared less. I remember that look on his face, and it's always stuck with me. So long story short, his name drops Sakuraba and Josh Barnett, who I was familiar with. And I'm like, okay, what's your name again? You know, as soon as he walks out the door, I'm getting on the internet and I'm looking him up. I'm like, holy shit, this is a real dude.
Right.
You know?
And he just walks into your door.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't see him for a couple weeks, but I knew where he was staying because he mentioned it. And so I literally like went to his apartment and I was like, dude, you coming? Like, I was so curious to work out with him. And he's like, oh, yeah, yeah, I was going to come down there. And we worked out a deal where he taught at the gym for about 5 years, man. And, he changed. That's a good way to segue. Like, so I learned most of my leg locks from a guy named Max Bishop. And Max Bishop.
Oh, sure. I know the name.
Yeah. He's amazing. And he is a black belt under Gokhar Chavichian.
Yep.
Learned from Gene LaBelle.
Yep. Very catch wrestling. Yep.
Yeah. So, I remember the first time I worked with Max Bishop, and he blew my mind. He literally blew my mind. I couldn't believe it. I'd already been training for such a long time. And it was the same thing with Billy. Billy was showing some things on the Kimura. Obviously, that was like his bread and butter that he would teach at a lot
of
seminars. And
yes.
Stuff. And you know, it just blew my mind. I never had it explained to me that way. And So 80% of my leg locks came from Max Bishop directly. Like I'm straight up just a carbon copy of him.
You know? Sure.
But Billy Robinson taught me some leg locks as well. But more importantly, something that I go over in my app, which is the legal leg lock app, I really go over is the power sources. And so when you're doing a leg lock, you have to understand where are you generating the power to break this leg, you know? And so Billy Robinson really helped me understand the power sources. And that was this one conversation with him on the mats that really clicked and had a profound ripple effect with my leg locks. And so even though 80% of the techniques came from one individual who also was very catch oriented, you know, the dominant fundamental of power sources coming from Billy and how the body works and how to derive the power, that's really what allowed me to start snatching ankles. And man, I have no idea how many ankle lock victories I have, but I have a lot of them. And, you know, they can all be like traced back to one day on the mat with Billy.
Well, it's funny that you mention Max, and then in a circuitous way, kind of the Gokor Gene LaBelle stuff. You know, I still think a lot of people sleep on Gokor, because I went before I met Billy and before I hooked up with Carl Gotch. You know, I was living in LA, and I went to North Hollywood when they had that old dojo back probably 2004. And I worked out a little bit with Manny and Gokor, and I actually got a role with Gokor. And it was really before I gotten tuned up with Billy. But man, I mean, I wasn't a slouch, you know, but Gokor was just another level, man. Gokor, people sleep on that whole set of grappling, in my opinion.
No, I've rolled with Gokor, and I'm here to tell you the dude's a master.
He's insane.
I don't use that term. You know what I mean? Like, he's a master. He is not a black belt. He's a master grappler.
Yes.
And I mean, I've rolled with Rodolfo Vieira. I've rolled with Bushesha when he wasn't even a black belt yet. Like, I've been around. I'm here to tell you. Gokar is freaking amazing.
No, man, that guy was like, and you know, like I said, this was before I got really tuned up by who I really consider guys that improved my game like tremendously. But I was really, I was pretty decent. And man, you know that just, you wrestle somebody and they're just fucking foot sweeping you at will, and there's just nothing you can do about it. It's like almost comical. It was. Gokor, I think he needs a lot more recognition for his ability. He's amazing. So you did the legal leg locks, and then you followed up with illegal leg locks.
Yeah, that was a fun one. I want to, you know, like we were talking before the podcast about passion projects and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, you know, the leg lock apps, you know, they're not paying my bills. That's to say it lightly.
But no,
like,
believe me, I know.
Yeah. So like, I was like, you know what, dude? I had met Vlad Kulikov, and I'm a big fan of him as a person, and of course, I'm fascinated with Sambo. And I was like, dude, let's do a instructional together. And he's like, he was all for it, you know. And so we did that one together, and you know, I got like. So you get known for like IBJJF legal leg locks. Well, like my heel hooks and my knee bars are, you know, well, my knee bars are legal, but you know, my heel hooks, inverted heel hooks, these things are, I'm very good at those as well. So it was nice to show some of the stuff that I was doing, in that one. And of course, Vlad, had some great, details as well, some great techniques. So that's a good app. You know, we go over some good stuff in that one.
So you have the legal leg locks app, you have the illegal leg locks app, and then what, describe the prison escapes.
Yeah. Prison escapes is just leg lock escapes. And so we go over some preventative stuff, like, you know, how to stay out of them, and then like different layers of defense, certain leg lock positions, and the actual leg locks themselves. So the prison escapes is, you know, those apps are like really cheap. I think they're like $30 or something, $25. So like, it's really good content. It's really good value type stuff. And the stuff that's in there it's not jujitsu based stuff. It's, you know, but I didn't learn my leg locks from jujitsu. I learned my leg locks from catch and sambo. So, there's, you know, good stuff in there from, that meets the needs of people that are looking for that kind of oriented stuff.
Well, and not to toot the catch horn too much, but even the Sambists recognize that their leg locks originated with the catch wrestler. So it's still like you know, I can't remember the name of the coaches, but a couple of them have been like, yeah, all our stuff came from the old catch wrestling stuff. Then it got modified and became Sambo specific. But so we're going to take a break real quick. But after the break, I want to talk to you about some of the some Billy stories and some of the challenges. I mean, you know, Billy was truly a genius, truly, truly like a savant when it came to wrestling. But sometimes that's not all roses either to work with him. And so I just wanted to commiserate with you and share some of those funny stories and stuff after we get back. So guys, hang in there. We got Rolly Delgado, Ultimate Fighter alum, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. He will be back and we're going to talk a little bit more about the role of catch wrestling in his life and Billy Robinson. Hang in there. We'll be right back. All right. We are back. The Do It Again podcast. I am your host, Jake Shannon. On the other end of the line, none other than Rolly Delgado. Rolly, are you there?
I'm here, brother.
Okay. So before the break, we were kind of talking leg locks. We were talking catch wrestling, Billy Robinson, the IBJJF, all these kind of disparate subjects. So Billy comes into your gym. You don't know who he is. You go look him up, you go track him down. And so he comes and starts, working, teaching classes. It was like what, like one or two classes, a week or something, or something
yeah,
like that. I can't remember.
Two or three. Yeah. Something like that.
And you start kind of picking up a thing or two here, a lot of Max Bishop, a lot of that go-core kind of stuff. And then you add in a little Billy Robinson. It's funny because I remember one time you gave me a call and you're like, man, look, I don't know what to tell you, but Billy's scaring people away from my gym. It's like hard for business. And it's the truth because, you know, for Billy, you know, the way that like, I ran a gym for a short time and shit, man, how long is Westside? By the way, guys, check out westsidemma.com. That's Rolly's gym down in Arkansas. So if you're anywhere nearby, pop in, say hi to Rolly. But how long you been running Westside now?
Since 2006, 13 years.
Wow. Wow. And, you know, there's challenges, right? Because the vast majority of people, and tell me if I'm wrong here, my experience, the vast majority of people that come to your gym, they're not there to be a part of a fighter's gym, like actually like go fight and cut you a percentage of the purse. And that's how you make a living. They're there to get exercise, to learn how to fight these things, but they're not like hardcore athletes. Maybe you have 20%.
I'll tell you like this. So I've been open for 13 years. Obviously I fought in the UFC and so did some of my students. I currently have somebody fighting on the Contender Series.
Nice.
August 27th, who's trained only at my gym.
What's his name or her name?
It's TJ Brown.
Okay.
He's got to fight 145. Absolute stunning guy. And then Bryce Mitchell's 2-0 in the UFC. Also fights at 145.
Right on.
He's 2-0. So I have these two fighters, right, that are absolute like workhorses. And then I have maybe five other amateurs. But I have 330 students.
Right.
You know, and so it's not MMA. I'm actually getting rid of my cage for a cage wall to make more space because majority of my students are there to get in shape doing kickboxing or part of the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu program. And we have a really good no-gi program as well that incorporates, obviously, all of the other arts as well, including catch and sambo. But yeah, like, so to say all that, most of the people are average Joes looking for a community and fitness, and they're defending themselves, learning to defend themselves at the same time. And that's a tough adjustment for Billy because Billy's worked with a lot of guys that had wrestling backgrounds, guys that were professional fighters. And those that type of training is good for that type of training. But for group classes or business, you know, we would have like middle-aged guys that were out of shape, and he's trying to show them a suplex. The first problem is they're not capable of doing it. You know, they're not supple enough, as he would say.
Yeah.
And so that's the first problem. The second problem, it wasn't appropriate for them to be learning suplexes. They needed to be learning more fundamental things. And the third problem was they would get injured.
Yeah.
So you just, the classes just dwindled down to next to nothing. And so I think we started off with him like teaching 3 days a week, and we had to take it down to 2 days a week. And then it got to where he had like two or three diehards, and you know, it was just, it was tough. It just wasn't very conducive. But one of the, I feel really bad because Billy was so old and so banged up that it was so hard for him to show us what he wanted to show.
I know.
It was a very, like, you would learn things in like four or five steps, but that makes it very hard to teach because, you know, for me, my style of coaching is a little different than Billy's. I'm a big gross motor skill guy and then refine it along the way.
Sure.
He wanted it to be perfect before he started drilling it. That was a very difficult thing for people to get because he would be showing them seven steps, but the move didn't really work in seven steps. The move needed to work in one fluid motion. And so, like, I would see a lot of those problems. And I think part of it was Billy never grew up seeing martial arts as an income generating business.
No. You made the money fighting. And if you couldn't make money fighting, then fuck off.
Yeah. So that's a different world he came up in. And then he was just, you know, his body, his mind was still there. I mean, he, like you said, man, he was a genius. He was so brilliant. I never asked him a question where he didn't just have the answer. And it was always a very good answer.
Yeah, and it wasn't bullshit. It wasn't, I mean, it was like a deep, like he had really thought about this or really had figured it out.
I tell people he was my Hicks and Gracie.
Yeah.
I mean, people hold Hickson to that standard. I've never met Hickson. I'm not a hype man. I don't believe in hype. But whatever that is, he was that for me. I could go to him. I got him 20 years too late, you know?
Like, yep.
That's just what it was. But I remember certain times asking him questions. He always blew my mind.
Well, that was the greatest thing about, you know, going around with him and helping him because really, you know, my value add was that for a couple of reasons. One, I had already known Carl Gotch pretty well, so I'd kind of broken into the mindset a little bit and had worked out with guys like Fujiwara and Gene LaBelle and these other guys. So, you know, my value add was really that I was a body and I was a bit of a Billy whisperer, you know, like the dog whisperer or something, you know, like, or the horse whisperer. Like I could actually, tell me if I'm wrong. He'd get really frustrated and pissed off when you didn't understand what you had to do. And so, you know, that was my value add was I understood what he was saying. I could do it. I could execute and translate it to these guys. But, you know, it was a challenge too. I mean, I really had to kind of sell it, you know, getting poked with, hit with the cane and yelled at and cursed at as more of like, I had to figure out how to pitch that as more like a rite of passage for these guys, you know what I mean? Because, I mean, you know better than anybody. He could be really, like, impatient.
Yeah, he was a tough guy from a tough town, from a tough country.
And a tough time.
And a tough time. And, you know, we're the softest generation in the history of the world.
So, right.
You know, that's a tough balance. And you were talking about being, like, the Billy Whisperer. That like, Hillary Williams was a black belt world champion, and she placed at Abu Dhabi, like, 3 years into training. Like, unbelievable athlete. And she was one of my students. And that's what she would say. She's like, I can't learn from Billy, but I can learn from you. And same with Max Bishop, you know. She could learn from me better than Max. And so I was the same I was the same type of thing, you know. Like, just
You could understand the concepts and then almost digest it and help other people understand what the heck is actually being said.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're in the same boat, but we have a lot of the, you know, we have some of those similar personality types anyway. So it doesn't surprise me that we both kind of fell into similar roles.
We both were big, like, Ron Paul people. We were both, you know, really into entrepreneurship, both into the martial arts, both kind of having this catch wrestling thing, you know, in our sphere. So I've always enjoyed, bullshitting with you. And like we talked before, maybe what we should do is, maybe do like a joint seminar or something up here, because I know people would love to learn leg locks from you up here.
Yeah. I think it would be really exciting, and it's not hard to get me to want to go to Colorado. It's one of my favorite places on the planet. So I'm down to set something like that up.
That's fantastic. Okay. So, and I don't want to keep you because you've been very generous with your time, but, so in addition to all the stuff that you're doing from, I mean, cause you're still competing, I'm 46, And my body, just because of my medical history and stuff, kind of crapped down around 35. So you've had some longevity. How long have you been competing?
Since I was 15. So, I'm 37 now. So,
wow. Yeah,
that's 22 years.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing.
I feel very fortunate to be able to still do it. I'm banged up, you know. I've had surgery on my right wrist and my right shoulder, and I have a really bad C6, C7 herniation. I mean, we all have issues.
Yeah.
But, like, they all affect us differently. And I'm at a place now where my grips are really bad because my left wrist needs surgery. And so I'm at a place.
Let me ask you something. Did you get your cervical injuries before your wrist and shoulder?
No, not my right wrist. But you know what? I think I had the cervical injuries longer than I realized, because I would have like that trigger point in my shoulder,
yep,
the scapula. And so I'm not really sure. I have a really long, skinny neck, so I think I would have had neck issues regardless.
Yeah, same.
But being put in guillotines and triangle chokes
constantly,
you know, for 20 years. But yeah, I think I'm just such an ectomorph that it was just difficult on my body. You know, I wasn't built to be a fighter. I'm not a I'm a tactician. I'm just like, you know, I was an insecure kid who used martial arts to learn how to defend himself. And I used MMA to prove to myself that I could do it. And then I was winning because I was, you know, it was a day. When I started fighting MMA, we were fighting traditional martial artists. So if you knew any grappling, it was taking candy from a baby. And so I didn't have a lot of tough amateur fights. But, you know, and I started fighting as a professional. And it was all because it was just a game to me. I was gaming the system. I'm tougher than your average guy, but when you get me around a bunch of tough guys, I'm not tough.
No, I am so with you on this, because, you know, I damaged my C2 and my C5 and my T1 pretty bad when I was like 22 doing grappling, right? I started in 94 with the Gracie, when the Gracies were touring and stuff right after UFC. And it's funny because the C2 and C5, my right arm is jacked. And so I just was curious, like, if maybe you had a cervical injury and that affected your ability to, like, execute. Because I finally had to stop wrestling because my right arm stopped working.
Yeah, I had to take 4 months off at the worst. And so I had some atrophy on my left arm.
Nothing, yeah,
like, super visible yet, but consistent Charlie horses and pain in my tricep. And now, you know, I was researching surgeries at this point. And luckily, with 4 months of rest and cleaning my diet up a little bit, it subsided. And now I have random tingling in both hands, but nothing that would justify surgery. And I'm back on the mats competing. Now, you know, you have to roll without an ego when you start having neck issues. And so
right.
There's times that I feel compromised and I just concede. I tap and I don't, and I just, you know, I tap to get out of the position, you know?
No, it's smart. Yeah, it's
so
smart.
It's how it has to be. I really cherish the moments of competing now, because I'm at a place now where I don't put as much pressure on myself as I did when I was younger.
Yeah.
So I can actually enjoy competing, because I realize nobody gives a shit. Nobody cares if I lose.
Yeah, and you know, it's I really feel, you know, MMA is such a weird I mean more than just business. Like, it's a weird lifestyle in a way, because you're right. Like, the fans, I don't think MMA fans are the best fans in the world, to be honest with you.
That's fair.
You know, I really don't. Like, it's funny because I guess I'm about 10 years older than you. And when I was really going, you know, I was, again, like I mentioned at the beginning, I've always been a long, lanky guy, you know, and I don't have the quote unquote look. And when I was doing it and in my prime, it was impossible to get booked on a show, man. I could not find a fucking MMA promoter to get in on. And I was doing pretty good. You know what I mean? I was like above average. I think I could have got booked, but in a later era, but you ended up like really like that Ultimate Fighter. That was a very special show. And in my opinion, the Ultimate Fighter show was a reality pro wrestling show, because it was just like pro wrestling, except not scripted, right? Like, you had the backstage vignettes and the drama in the house, and then that was resolved in the ring, and these kind of things.
Yeah, yeah. What sells, sells. You know, human nature is human nature. It's been the same since the dawn of time.
So how, tell me, because I'm fascinated and a little envious, but, you know, you're a friend, and I, you know, I love you, brother, and I just want to hear, what was your story? That's why I ended up going into pro wrestling. I could get into pro wrestling, but there was not hardly any competitions back in like 96, 97, you know, that yeah. at the grassroots level. So you fast forward like 10 years. How did you get involved? Like, what was that?
So I started, you know, I had watched the UFC and had seen Royce Gracie doing his thing. And I thought, oh, this makes sense. I had two semesters of wrestling. So I knew, like, man, like, if somebody doesn't, it's just that simple. And so I'm watching the UFC and it's making sense to me. And so I started training after I moved to Little Rock when I was 15. And the guy who was who owned the gym also promoted some amateur MMA. And at the time, amateur MMA for here in Arkansas, they didn't allow strikes to the face on the ground. So you could do everything standing. We weren't wearing headgear and shin pads.
What year? What year is this?
98, 99.
Wow.
Yeah, it's old school, man.
Wow. Yeah, this is before the commissions were brought in or anything.
There were no commissions at this point. I mean, I got to see all of that happen.
Wow, dude, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like I got in at an amazing time.
Oh.
I was just old enough to train with the adults. You know, I was 15.
Oh my God, that's great. So,
yeah, to be 37 and to be old school is a neat.
That's so rad. So, okay, so it's 98. You get booked on these amateur MMA cards.
Yeah.
Is he somehow connected, or did you have a tryout, or what was the deal?
No. There wasn't nothing like that. They just needed fights. So, like, you know, like, it was almost like you'd get talked into doing it.
No. I'm talking about, like, the Ultimate Fighter, though.
Oh, to get on the Ultimate Fighter, there were tryouts in Boston, and so I flew up there to the tryouts, and I wore a pink singlet to stand out.
Nice.
So I tapped the dude like a couple times that I was wrestling with. We had a minute and a half of wrestling.
That's some Gene LaBelle shit, by the way. That's awesome.
Yeah,
because he had that pinky too.
Yeah, he had the pink. That's right. And then we hit pads, and I can hit pads, and so and then we went to the interview, and you know, obviously I like to talk, and I can read the landscape, and so I gave them what they wanted. I'm actually like a really chill person, and but I played out like I was a little more like cavalier. And
yeah, a little pro wrestling, man. You cut a promo, cut some promos.
Yeah, and I got in, you know, and then I was on the Ultimate Fighter. But I wasn't training for MMA at that point. There was no, for a long time, there wasn't even a 155-pound weight class.
Let alone 155. Yeah.
And so I had stopped. I had I had a labral tear that I had surgery on, and I was fighting for like $500 here and there. And so I stopped fighting because it just didn't make sense anymore. And then I tried out for the Ultimate Fighter, went on the Ultimate Fighter. I didn't win on the Ultimate Fighter. I didn't do well. And I didn't deserve to because I wasn't training for it. But then they brought everybody back to fight on the show, which was a stroke of luck for me. And then I fought one of my teammates who was a very good kickboxer, not a very good grappler. So I submitted him. And then, you know, I had two more fights in the UFC. I lost a decision to Paul Kelly, which was I feel like I should have got the decision, but it wasn't a robbery. And I was a 5-1 underdog. That was still a pretty good experience because it was a great fight. And then I got knocked out in my third fight and got cut. Then I went to Bellator, did one fight, won that fight. And then I went 3-1 in my next four fights, retired on a loss, and went and opened a pawn shop because I was ready to go make some money.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, there's no money in this. let me ask you this. So, and I want to talk about that because I think it's important. Like, you always have to have something to fall back on, you know, financially. And I want to talk about that because I think you've been very smart in that regard. But before we kind of close out the MMA thing, I did want to get your opinion, you know, on all the concussion stuff. I mean, how are you doing? You don't have CTE or anything like that.
Yeah, I don't. I did do some hard sparring. Most of that happened post Ultimate Fighter. So my window of like training like a madman was probably 3 years.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just off the cuff. I don't know exactly how long it was. But we had some gym wars, you know, and I don't feel like I have the body that can hold up to that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I'm doing fine. I really have a bad short-term memory, but I think it's because I just have so many irons in the fire.
Sure.
So scatterbrained. But I'm not dealing with any issues. I did get knocked out only once. But being so tall, man, I didn't take a lot of damage. Never
broke, right.
29 MMA fights, never a broken nose, never a laceration on the face.
Your reach was always longer than the other guy. Yeah.
That's right. And a lot of times people didn't like – for a long time, people would take me down because of the reach. And then I was way better on the ground than standing.
Right.
It worked out for me. But, yeah, so I was very fortunate in that respect. But we used to train – like we used to bang it out, and now my gym's totally changed. I mean, we've evolved, and I still think people need to spar hard when they're getting into the sport because you need to learn those lessons of what it feels like to get hit before
Yeah.
But then once that lesson's learned, there's no reason to keep creating it because we've already established that, you know, you know how to take it, and then we don't need to keep giving it to you. And if you're going to take the damage, you need to be getting paid for it. You know, it needs to matter. So we don't go too hard now.
Yeah, I mean, I had a point when, you know, 2003, I was like still like toying with this idea of getting into MMA, and I went to the first Team Quest camp, you know, with Couture and Lin and all those guys. And I remember, man, I was doing great on the grappling. I had no problem there. I was like really feeling confident, really feeling strong about, you know, my performance. But they laced us up and I was sparring boxing with Ryan Schultz, right? From remember the International Fight League and all that.
Uh-huh. I remember the name.
And man, he rung my bell, and that was the decision point. I was like, nope, no MMA. Because like to your point about you got to get your bell rung, dude, and figure out if this is what you want to do or not, because it's what it is. That's part of the game. And man, I got my bell rung hard by Ryan, and he was a weight class under me. And I was like, fuck, man, if this guy's in a lower weight class, I can't imagine this is going to get any better. So I stuck to grappling. I was like, no, I'm just going to focus on catching, on grappling, and not.
Well, send Ryan Schultz a bottle of scotch. He saved you a lot of BS.
Yeah, you know, you're right. And he lives here in Colorado. I should probably reach out to him. And it's funny you say that. Maybe you're psychic because I'm sitting here. I actually was holding in my hand my bottle of Oban scotch as you said that.
Nice.
That's pretty creepy, dude. You got magic powers, man. So, okay, we're going to do another break and then we'll come back. And I do want to talk about some of your entrepreneurial ventures because, you know, I'm a crazy nerd for entrepreneurship and I think you've done really well. And I think it's something that people that, you know, all this shit, it's really hard to get rich or even really support a family, to be honest, with MMA. You've got to have some other, that's got to be, or grappling or whatever. You've got to have a main hustle because this stuff is kind of a passion play. And, you know, while I don't really, I break even, you know, I don't take any losses, but it's not a huge thing. And I think it's important for people in the sport to make sure that they've got something to fall back on. So hang on, guys. We'll be right back. Got Ultimate Fighter alum, BJJ Black Belt, Rolly Delgado, and Catch Wrestling Leglock guy with us today. So we'll be back. Hang in there. Just got to keep the lights on with these sponsors. We'll be right back. And we are back. Rolly, are you still there?
I am here.
Okay, wonderful. So you mentioned that you bought a pawn shop.
I didn't buy one. I started one.
You started a pawn shop. Oh my gosh. Okay. What the hell? That's got to be a weird business in itself. I mean, one, you're already in a weird business with this MMA grappling stuff. And then you started a pawn shop. How was that?
I liked it. The problem was, and it's still open. It was a success, but, I sold my partnership to my partner. I like it because, you know, people need short-term loans and they're collateralized, you know, they're secured. And so it's a very safe business and the returns are amazing because obviously it's they're short-term loans. So the interest is really high.
Mm-hmm.
We avoid usury laws in most states by the nature of the business. And so it was good. My problem with it was, you know, I've been self-employed for so long, and then all of a sudden I was in a brick and mortar situation where, you have to be there from 9 to 5:30. That's a notoriously difficult business to scale. And I just realized I was too young to be sitting inside of a building that many hours a day. And then I was still running my gym at night. So I did that for a couple of years. And like I said, it's still going well. Learned a lot doing it. And it wasn't like TV. People don't bring you like historic revolutionary muskets that George Washington held one day or something.
Yeah, it's not like Pawn Stars or whatever.
Not at all. So, you know, we're doing loans on gold, diamonds, laptops, and gaming systems, things of that nature. But yeah, you know, you just build your loan base up and people pay interest on the loan so they can finally get it back, or they default and you sell their stuff. Real simple business.
But you mentioned like the usury laws, and most people don't know even the word usury. So that has to do with interest and too much interest. Like it's to protect people against loan sharks and shit like that. So, there wasn't a lot of red tape. I would think there would be like the state would be totally on your ass.
Yeah, no, Arkansas is so not like that. I mean, Arkansas is a great place to start a business.
Oh, good.
We still have headaches, but like, it's not like New York. There's always like a gray area with it, but a lot of, states have a lobbying group for pawn shops.
I see.
And in some states, it's just kind of like, yeah, that's different. I can't really speak to it on a legal level. I just know, like at one point, there was an attorney that was going to try to do a class action lawsuit against pawn shops here in Arkansas. And I was already getting out of the business at this point, but it just turned into nothing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. But typical usury law in Arkansas is like 18.99% per year. And we were charging 20% a month. So that's 240%.
Wow.
Secured us. But you know what? Like, how are you going to lend somebody $50 on 18% annual? Like,
well, and people don't understand. People don't understand the risk. They don't understand the trade-off about, like, I mean, it's the same thing with all these, like, subprime loans and stuff. You know, like, people, at least with a collateralized debt, you know, you're not in the same risk category. Like a lot of these subprime loans, they just had to write all that debt down when the people couldn't pay it back.
Well, and they were putting it into a bond and selling it. So that was a little different and a big nightmare. But like,
yeah, secondary markets.
So I would never get 20% monthly on a big, big loan. Like you would negotiate, that would get negotiated down. And I really never had the opportunity to do, you know, $5,000 loans and stuff. I mean, most of the loans we were doing $1,200. Well, no, those weren't most, but like most of my big loans were in that like $1,200.
Right.
Big loans. So yeah, like if they loan borrow $1,000, they got to come back with $1,200 to get their stuff back.
Yeah.
And so like, that's nice. You know, that was like an easy loan. You made $200, but it was a lot of small loans. People have budgeting issues and they would, you know, they need to borrow $50 to keep the electricity on or buy some medicine or buy food or whatever.
Yeah, emergency stuff. Labor. And they couldn't get cash anywhere else. And here you are. So you get out of the business, you sell your part of the partnership. And then what? And is that when you got your realtor license or?
No, I've owned rental properties since like 2003, I guess.
Nice.
So I've had like four rentals now for forever. I'm done buying rentals, but like, so I've had the rental property for a long time. I finally realized that you can't beat them, join them when it came to real estate. And I got my realtor license last year. And because I have such a big gym, we have 330 members, and then I own some other gyms. I know everybody around here. So I don't have to spend a lot of time marketing myself. I
just right.
make a Facebook post here and there. And I'm not trying to do that much real estate. Like I'm just trying to do the deals when they come my way. So if I can make some extra cash closing some deals, then I'm going to do it. And that's kind of my attitude with it. I actually talk people out of buying houses more than I actually find them houses, because I know all about it as an investor. And I'm like, oh, dude, you're leaving in 3 years. Why would you buy a house? You're going to have to pay a realtor.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pay closing costs. You're going to have to do repairs. Like, this makes no sense for you.
Well, you're diversified too. So you don't have to do that hard sell because you don't put food on the table. You got multiple gyms, you got rental properties, you have yourself diversified. So you can tell somebody, hey, don't buy this.
I really am just a relationship guy. I like long-term relationships. And I don't want to burn anybody, and I'm not trying to be like holier than thou about it, but I really just want to be customer centric. Like, I want you to be able to talk to me and know that I'm not going to push something on you that's not good for you. And in the long play, you know, when somebody has a $1 million idea,
right,
an investor, they're going to come to me because they can trust me. And so
I don't
want to play the short game. So it's cool to be a realtor like that, because I'm laid back as heck. You know, if the deal falls through, the deal falls through. I had a guy list a house with me the other day, and, you know, I bought the photographs. I advertised it. I took him to see a bunch of different properties. He changed his mind. No big deal.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I want you to do it.
The cost of business. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the way it goes. You know, it's not a big deal. So, but you're right, because I'm not, you know, if I needed that sale to feed my son, it would be a different story. But luckily, that's not the case.
Are you strictly residential, or are you selling commercial?
No. I dabble with land a little bit, but I partner up with another agency because that's their focus. And there's a lot of factors: mineral rights, soil types.
Yeah.
You know, precision leveled.
Water shares and stuff like that.
Yeah, not as much here as you guys have in Colorado. But so I stay in my lane, but I love land. And that's one of my big avenues to grow into in the next year or two. I want to find some income producing farmland. So I do a little bit of that. I don't do any commercial. But the way that works is, as a realtor, if somebody wants to buy commercial land, what I do is then I refer them to somebody else, and I still get a really healthy referral fee.
Mm.
And then I can like tag along for the project and learn. But I would be doing somebody a disservice to represent them, even though I legally can. I'm licensed to do commercial.
It's just not your expertise.
It's a different ball game, man. I mean, it's just a different world. And if you don't speak that language, you could do some harm for your clients.
Right. So you own the MMA gym, right? It's you and Matt. Is that fair?
Right. Yeah,
right. Matt Hamilton. And then, and then you've opened up and kind of taken, they're mostly what, kickboxing gyms, you say?
Yeah, I have two fitness kickboxing gyms, just kind of running off that just fitness market.
Yep.
No fighters, no real sparring. Just
yeah, fitness. That. Yeah.
And then, you know, we recently opened up a different jiu-jitsu gym that's going to be tailored more towards kids.
Ah.
So I've got an interest in those gyms, and I've got the real estate thing going. I've got, you know, some rental properties that are more of the long play. And that's really all I'm doing at the moment.
That's awesome. Listen, we're kind of running out of time. Guys, check out what Rolly's up to. If you're out in Arkansas, hit up Westside MMA. It's westsidemma.com. Go to Digitsu, DIGITSU.com, and look up Rolly, Rolly Delgado, DELGADO. And then if you guys are interested, if this is something you think you might want to do, if you want like a joint seminar with me and Rolly, we could do some catch stuff and then Rolly really dig deep into the leg lock stuff. Send me a message, training@scientificwrestling.com. Rolly, thanks a ton for your time today, brother.
Yeah, absolutely. And man, if we get a good response on that, I'd love to do a session with you. I've got some great stuff that I've learned from Billy. You know, he was there for 5 years. And
yeah.
I've got some great stuff that I learned from Max that I feel like I also have some really good modern stuff. You've got to, one of my things that value I add to jiu-jitsu people is I bring the catch and the sambo flair to it.
Yes.
Something I add to the sambo and catch people is I can also think like a jiu-jitsu guy. So like in certain positions, I can tell you where their mind is and where it isn't. And so I'm always looking for the path of least resistance. And those are some tricks that I can show in those seminars.
Awesome. Well, us lanky grapplers got to stick together. Rolly, I really appreciate your time. Guys, again, check out westsidemma.com. And Rolly, we'll have to do this again soon.
Heck yeah. Thanks so much for having me on.
All right. Thank you, sir.